What's up, everybody? And thanks again for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives with me, Cam Hale, and of course, the man that needs no introduction, El Diablo himself, Kyle Filson.
How's it going, everybody? I'm here in studio. I'm ready for today's show. I feel good. I just had a coffee. There's some kind of like snickerdoodle flavor.
And
it's pretty good, but look, I know a lot of people, you're not manly if you put any kind of creamer in your coffee. You know, you guys are supposed to drink it straight.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm not manly because I like creamer in mine, and I do, and it doesn't matter. Now, I don't go like French hazelnut or anything like that, French vanilla.
But you like snickerdoodle.
Or hazelnut, but hey, they got
You can't hate on either one of those you just offered then if you like snickerdoodle.
I like that. I like snickerdoodle. I like, there's this chocolate truffle.
That you talked me into that one time, and I don't use creamer, but I did like that.
Yeah. Regular creamer I'm not too big on. Half and half is okay, but look, just like I'm in awe of people who drink scotch straight, neat, can't do it. If I drink just black coffee, I'm like, I can do it, but I'm like, golly, it's a little strong.
I drink it every now and again, but I like one, this sounds ridiculous, one scoop of sugar is all I put in my coffee.
I like sugar
in
there. Yeah.
One little scoop of sugar, that's it. No cream or anything, but every now and again, I like a hot milkshake. So I have to go, and like you're talking about, I have to get one that's got it revved up.
Gotcha.
You know, I gotta have it dressed up, if you will. But I do.
I've been putting a little CBD oil in my coffee in the morning. I think it makes me feel better. A little pep in my step.
Right.
I don't know. Maybe it's just a placebo or psychological, but I think that I feel better.
It's funny you brought it up. I had coffee right before I got here. So if we're a little spun off, folks, it's because we're all coffeeed up right now.
Favorite coffee is the Civet Cat.
I love cat poop coffee.
Yeah. I'm in actuality, my favorite usually blends are from like Ethiopia or Sumatran. I really like those blends.
Kyle likes it when I eat the coffee beans and excrete them, and then he goes through it, and then he makes his coffee out of it.
It's a complicated process involving a French press, a grinder, a Bunsen burner, several beakers that aren't allowed to be purchased in this state. I have to go to a neighboring state.
That's right. And a newspaper.
Yeah. I'm on the watch list for, like, crystal meth manufacturer.
He gets a whole lot of, what is the...
Sudafed
delivered
to
his house.
Like, you don't know the ingredients of crystal meth.
As I'm sitting there holding this little battery that Kyle was cursing at, we'll get into that later, about this thing that's in a controller that's a tiny battery. But
he's a local landowner, and he actually owns some land down where a lot of meth production takes place. It's real cheap. Like, you can get, like, an acre for, like, $5,000, maybe.
I can hook you up with some Gatorade bottle meth.
Yeah, you can get a lot of stuff down there.
Right? Wowzers. Yeah, for sure. Hey, Brad, I got you something here you're going to like.
Okay.
I found someplace. I actually went digging around this weekend to get... I know you give me a hard time about going to certain websites over and over and over again.
I think that you probably own?
Yes, yeah. So I'm finally breaking that one today because in you know, observance of you, sir, of standing up to this, I found a website talking about two Kansas motorists that encounter Bigfoot. The website is Cryptozoology News.
Folks. Yes.
It is two women, that's right, in Kansas. Now, honestly, they probably saw this creature from at least 15 miles away, because I'm pretty sure Kansas is flat, and if it stands taller than corn, then you're going to see it a long ways off.
Kansas is pretty flat, although I think Nebraska is probably flatter. Well, the way where I've driven at.
Well, when I stayed in Kansas, I went up when my mother stayed up there, and I went when I was younger up in there, and it's not near like I had played it out in my mind. But you're right, Nebraska,
flat. Nebraska's really good if you want to fly kites.
Yeah. If you're looking to get distance with your golf ball or your disc golf disc.
Or say if you're into long-distance, high-powered rifle competitions.
Yeah.
I mean, you can shoot.
If you like stretching string flat for as long as you can possibly see.
Yeah, drag racing would be good.
Yeah,
where you can really open her up.
You can really give her the onion. You can let her eat. So these two sisters claimed that they were driving on Interstate 24 when they spotted this thing. Now, this is what they said. And they were telling the BFRO about this, and this allegedly happened in August of 2017 in Mitchell County, which is funny because Kyle's from Mitchell County.
Yep, that's right.
So, around 9:35 p.m., I was telling my sister, who was driving, to be careful about deer running across the road, because we had seen a few. And said some did not even look at the truck that we were in. They were mostly focused on the cornfields, which you know, would be right. You'd think about it. As they're crossing the road, they're just shooting across there. And she says that suddenly, and I love this description, a big, buff, gorilla-looking man hopped out on all fours out of the cornfield. So it sounds like she described you, Kyle. And it says that it jumped from the cornfield to my left in front of me and onto the left side of the road. It stood up then disappeared into the cornfield on the other side of the highway. My sister wanted to stop, but I asked her to continue driving. She goes on to describe this creature as 8 feet tall with an ape-like body and said that the hair was about 3 inches long, and much like Kyle, there's bald areas on its chest and face. But this is not like Mr. Filson, because she said you could see its muscles. The hair was dark, kind of reddish. Now, if you'll go to the link through the show notes, you'll see an amazing artist rendition of this Sasquatch grinning from ear to ear with giant. Now, look, we can laugh about this. I would like to have this printed off in a poster I would hang in the studio. This Sasquatch looks super friendly. Like if he drank your last beer or ate your last sandwich or used your last pieces of bread, that he would be sorry and actually go and get you some more. So, smiling Sasquatch.
Well, not every sighting of Sasquatch is hostile. I mean, there are people that report sightings that have like a kinship with them.
Yeah.
They're like buddy-buddy, that they'll leave out like apples or like some kind of beef jerky or gift for the Sasquatch. And then in return, the Sasquatch will sometimes bring them some river trout or something nice. Like, they're not always ominous, hateful beings looking to tear people apart.
It's true.
So maybe they, you know, they just bumped into a nice one.
And he just likes corn.
Who don't?
Who don't like corn? He's just a
everything's
corn.
Got corn in it.
Well, that's true.
Well, check this out. This comes from Science Alert. Scientists have found evidence that plants can actually hear the buzz of passing bees and produce sweeter nectar in response to entice the flying insects in. And flowers are technically these plants' ears. Based on observations of evening primroses, the team behind the new study discovered that within minutes of sensing sound waves of nearby bee wings through flower petals, the concentration of the sugar in the plant's nectar was increased by an average of 20%. The flowers even seemed able to tune out irrelevant background noises, such as the wind. Scientists are now saying that this capability could well give some plants an evolutionary advantage, maximizing their chances of spreading pollen. The scientists go on to say that our results document for the first time that plants can rapidly respond to pollinator sounds in an ecologically relevant way. Now, this comes from researchers from Tel Aviv University in Israel. Now, the scientists, they went into several experiments with a hypothesis in place that plants can indeed pick up the vibrations of sound waves, and that this might be part of the reason many plants' flowers are bowl-shaped to better trap the sounds. So, you know, you think about like a satellite dish or one of those big ear things that you see the guys mm-hmm. in the football field holding. Mm-hmm. Most flowers are shaped kind of that way, and they said that the reason that it's shaped that way is so that it can easily detect sounds, and this is a new thing. They said across several experiments involving more than 650 evening primroses, nectar production was measured in response to silence, sound at three different frequency levels, and just the recording of buzzing sounds made by bees. And it didn't matter whether the bees were real or just the recorded sounds of bees, the result was the same. Sure enough, both the field recording of the buzzing of bees and the low frequency sounds that closely matched the recording were enough to change the mix of the nectar in just 3 minutes.
Wow.
They said the silence in the high and mid-frequency sounds had absolutely no effect. The team also tried the experiments with plants that had some of its flower petals removed, and they said no change in nectar production was noted, indicating that it is indeed the flowers that have the job of the ears. Now, these lab tests were backed up by observations the team made in the wild, not just in their laboratory. And as it turns out, pushing out sweeter nectar means that bees may well stay feeding for longer, which increases the chance that they'll pick up even more pollen, and it makes more likely that the insects will return to flowers of the same species in the future. They say that this sweetness boosts the needs to be timed perfectly, though, so it makes it worth the flowers worthwhile, and that's exactly what seems to be happening. So it's an amazing thing. They knew that plants, of course, respond to light. Mm-hmm. They know that plants respond to sounds around them and things like that, but they didn't know that the flowers served more of a function than previously thought. Like before, they thought the color of the flowers was what attracted the bees. They seen a different spectrum, and that would draw them into the nectar. But now they know that just hearing the sounds of bees makes them up their sweetness of the nectar in just 3 minutes, Which makes sense to you because you've heard the studies of the opposite, where the playing of the recording of caterpillar sounds makes other trees change their leaves in the tasting foul so that they won't be eaten, right? They could talk about the certain trees can hear giraffes chewing the leaves.
Yes, and before they can get to them.
Downwind, it would actually affect the chemical taste of the leaves downwind from where those giraffes are feeding. So this is the same kind of thing, but just working in the opposite direction, making the flowers sweeter. So who would think that was even a possibility? They said that they're going to be looking at several other plants, and they want to see how they respond to other animals, and they want to see if these plants actually respond to humans, too. So you've heard the story. These have been around for a long time where people say, you know, if you have a garden or something, a greenhouse, put some classical music on, right? The plants will grow better. I don't know. Or talk kind to your plants. They'll grow better. You know,
it,
be
it
nice.
It makes you it has to. It really does. It has to. There's too many things now that are coming out where these plants, you just can't deny the fact that they are highly sensitive to their environment.
It makes me feel like the Na'vi on Avatar.
Yeah.
Hell, they're
you feel
more,
bad for every salad you eat now?
No, I don't. But I'm just saying, like, they're more in tune.
Yes.
Doesn't mean I wouldn't eat a plant still. I definitely would eat a plant. Speaking of Avatar, when's part two coming out?
They're probably filming it now.
I've been hearing about that forever.
Since the first one landed?
That's still a great show.
That's still a good movie, yeah.
But speaking of great things, I just read a recent book that was pretty interesting by a guy named Jack Strange, and it's called Strange Tales of the Sea. And when we get back from this break, I'm going to be talking about some of the stories in that. So stick with us, folks. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. We're back with Expanded Perspectives. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about a book I recently got a hold of. It's a book called Strange Tales of the Sea by Jack Strange. Now, Jack Strange, I believe, is a pseudonym. I think he's written several, or he or she, whoever it is, has written several books on strange things. But this one happens to do with the ocean. And for whatever reason, I don't know if it's like the romantic in me. Maybe it's because I don't have much experience on the ocean. I've been offshore fishing and things like that, but I've never been on a cruise. I never was in the Navy or things like that. It's because the ocean seems so mysterious to me, the depths, the creatures that live within, that I guess make it so appealing. So I really like this book. And if you like stories about the ocean and monsters and mermaids and things, you need to get a hold of this book. You can get it on Amazon. I'll put links to it in the show notes. The first story that the author talks about is the case of the Harewood. Now, the Harewood is a ship. Now, back in April 1874, the ship, the Harewood, was homeward bound from Pensacola, Florida, and it arrived one day out of the blue at the tail of the bank, just downstream from Glasgow, Scotland. Now, if you're not familiar with the area, the tail of the bank is a name given to the anchorage in the upper Firth of Clyde, immediately north of Greenock, or Gurrock. This area of the Firth gets its name from the sandbar immediately to its east, which marks the entrance to the estuary of the River Clyde. Now, the tail of bank was a significant point of embarkation for many travelers, especially immigrants, to either Canada and the United States of America. Now, when this ship arrived, some of the locals noticed, strangely, that some of the members of the crew appeared to be in an agitated state. And it wasn't long before rumors began to circle around some of the local pubs in town that there was something wrong with the Harewood. Now, as rumors go, there was a rumor that the ship was in fact haunted. One of the local reporters in the town began asking questions and apparently at some time spoke with multiple members of the crew. Now, of course, most didn't want to talk about it, but there was one man who didn't seem to mind. Now, this man gave his version of some of the strange events he witnessed while aboard the ship. He stated that a few days into their voyage, he noticed several of the crew members collecting into small groups and whispering among themselves about strange noises being heard aboard the ship. Now, these noises were not normal, and you have to remember that most of these men were seasoned sailors. He also told the reporter that he believed that the ship had been renamed. Now, you might be thinking to yourself, what's the big deal? But this is a major problem among sailors. It was common knowledge in those days that renaming a ship was bad luck. Apparently, the Harewood was formerly named the Victoria of London. This was kept secret to the crew until they were underway. Hell, if they had known that the ship was renamed, there wouldn't even be a crew. Now, this man, he believed that this was kept a secret, at least until they were out to sea. And about that point, what could you do? It wasn't like you could just jump in the water and swim home. You couldn't have a helicopter sent out to pick you up like you can on an offshore rig these days. Once you're on board, you were there for the duration, at least until they made it to land. So, now that the crew knew about the renaming, it seemed to feed these strange paranormal events. Several of the men believed that at night, they would hear strange moaning and groaning, as if someone was in deep distress. The man also told the reporter that the sounds seemed to grow louder and louder as the nights passed by, and that he definitely was not the only one to hear them. Now, one morning, he awoke at dawn, he said, only to see a strange figure standing by his bunk. And he said it was that of a young man. He looked about 27 years of age. Now, the seaman knew at once that the figure was not human. He also said that he knew that it was a foreigner and that it would not harm him. He didn't feel scared or frightened. He said the figure just stared at him before it finally retreated into a corner and pointed to a livid mark around the neck. He said all the time, the figure's lips were moving as if in prayer. After that, the seaman frequently saw the figure from night to night. He said it would always speak the same words again and again. He would say, I am not the man. I am not the man. It turns out later that an elderly man who was a banker had been murdered on board the Victoria of London, and another man named Miller had been hanged for the crime. The seaman believed that this figure, which was seen gliding along the deck by several crew members, was in fact the ghost of the executed Miller, who had come to protest his innocence. That is why he, along with several of the crew, saw him night after night and heard him say, I am not the man. I am not the man. Very interesting. The author goes on to tell other ghostly stories that people see on ships and things like that. The author also goes on to talk about how sometimes it was not uncommon for a ghost on a vessel to be known personally by the crew. Oftentimes, the ghost was a former member of the crew who had died by falling overboard and drowning or was killed in some sort of accident. And they go on to talk about how the spectral mariner could often lend his weight on a line when needed or give advice during a storm. This phenomenon, it kind of reminds me of the third man factor talked about by climbers or people that are lost in the wilderness. These benevolent spirits seem to help out those in need during a stressful situation, kind of like a guardian angel. I've spoken before about a person being lost in a terrible storm all by themselves, and after manning the wheel for hours on end, they eventually succumb to sleep. And at some point, they wake up, only to see a ghostly figure steering their ship. Later, they claim that if it were not for that ghost steering the ship throughout the night, they would have surely died. So these stories kind of remind me of those. Now, while British ships had ghosts, Scandinavian vessels that sailed the North Sea and the Baltic had their own little guests. These vessels reportedly have pixies or brownies on board, which could often be very welcome. One of the most fortunate ships in the early part of the 20th century was named Juno. And on board of Juno, it was reported that they had their own brownie. Now, a brownie, it's not a little girl that sells cookies. A brownie is a type of fairy or a type of fae folk. Now, according to the crewmen, many had seen this brownie holding the masts firm during the savage North Sea gales. And when the schooner, Fema, ran into the ship Juno, they said that the brownie was seen running along the anchor cable to look after both vessels. The brownie actually helped Juno to be both a safe and a prosperous ship. There's other legends that speak of ghosts on passenger liners, like the liner known as Utopia. Now, she was on her outward voyage from Italy and calling at Gibraltar when she collided with the HMS Anson. As soon as Utopia began to go down, vessels and boats of all sizes arrived to take off the passengers and the crew, but many were still on board when she sank. Now, Utopia's owners could not afford to lose such a valuable ship, so they had her salvaged, and she was towed into the dockyard in Gibraltar and refitted. As soon as it was practical, she returned to her previous work, carrying passengers on cruises and trips. However, things were not at all well. Passengers began to complain about strange sounds on board, and every time Utopia passed Gibraltar Bay, passengers and crew experienced the sinking again. They would hear the sounds of rushing water and the cries and screams of people drowning. After a while, the story spread, and it wasn't long until no one wanted to use the ship. The owners even had a difficult time finding a crew. So, eventually, the Utopia was sent to the breaker's yard. The author goes on to talk about one of the stranger stories that I've ever read was the case of the strange experience by a man named Mr. Wilmot, who was a passenger on the transatlantic steamer City of Limerick that was crossing from Liverpool to New York in 1863. The author points out that it was a stormy passage, and for a while, conditions were decidedly uncomfortable on board. When one gale at last began to ease, Mr. Wilmot clambered into his bunk and dreamed that his wife, who was safe on shore, would visit him. Sure enough, after a little while, she did. She was wearing her nightdress and looked a little uncomfortable to see that her husband shared his cabin with another passenger. But she remained long enough to check that he was all right, and then she departed. When Wilmot awoke, his companion, a man named Mr. Tate, was shocked that a woman would visit him in the night, and he too had seen Mrs. Wilmot. When Wilmot finally arrived in New York, his wife said that she had felt very anxious for his safety, and about a week earlier, and had crossed the sea to visit him in his cabin, but only in her dreams. She was somehow able to describe the cabin exactly, and knew that Mr. Tate had been watching her all the time. So, man, that is not a crazy story. So his wife is dreaming about her husband, and in her dream, she crosses the Atlantic to visit him and can describe the cabin completely and even knows about a Mr. Tate. Meanwhile, Mr. Wilmot is on the ship in the middle of the Atlantic with a guy named Mr. Tate, and they both see his wife there on the ship. Like, she just walked in the door, checked on him, how you doing, gave him a kiss and walked out. I don't know what that is. Astral projection? Remote viewing? I mean, I don't even know how to categorize that. Pretty interesting stuff. Anyways, let's move on. Sometimes, the author mentions, that there were things worse than ghosts at sea. In 1913, the British ship Johnson was sailing off the Pacific coast of South America when she sighted a ship off Punta Arenas, Chile. As the ships closed, the master of Johnson realized that the ship looked derelict and had green moss covering her masts. According to the story, a party actually boarded this mysterious vessel and found her crew only by 20 skeletons. The vessel was the Marlborough of Glasgow, which had sailed from Lyttelton in New Zealand in 1890 and had not been heard of since. So yeah, you heard me right. The Marlborough had been drifting unmanned across the Pacific Ocean for 23 years. Another story similar to this one is of the American ship named Star, or sometimes it's called the Star of Dundee. The author points out that seamen are notoriously superstitious, so there was some discomfort on board when the schooner, known as Star, put to sea with a crew of 13 men. However, it was the 20th century. People were more sophisticated, and nobody really believed that sort of nonsense, did they? At first, the voyage was fine, with the Pacific as smooth as the name suggested, and the crew working with a will, and Star performing as beautifully as a schooner could. However, as Star neared Midway Island, nearly in the center of the Pacific Ocean, the weather turned foul. Great rollers rushed on the small vessel, and the captain realized that they could not survive. When one particularly vindictive wave broke on board, he gave orders to abandon ship, just as Star ran aground on a coral reef. After a short while, in the lifeboats, a passing bark rescued the crew and took them to Seattle, where they reported the loss of their vessel. The Star was written off as just another casualty of the sea, and the crew signed on with other vessels. 6 months later, the master of the ship, Dune, reported that Star was afloat, under full sail, and heading to windward. The master of Dune was adamant that the vessel was the Star, and he knew her well. After a further 3 months, an oil tanker sighted Star, seemingly in ship shape, condition, and only 400 miles west of San Francisco. That meant that the schooner had sailed over 2,000 miles from the reef where her crew had abandoned her. There were also rumors that she was manned. Some crewmen of the tanker swore that they had seen seamen on board Star, dressed in clothes that have gone out of fashion centuries previously. By this time, the legend of Star was well known in the Pacific. So now ships were looking out for the mysterious schooner that refused to die. Now altering course, Star next appeared off Flanning Island, another 3,000 miles across the Pacific. But again, there was mention of men on board. This time, the reports were more specific. Star's new crew were dressed in the quilted doublets and baggy trousers of Elizabethan seamen. By the time Star reached Hull Island, another 1,000 miles away, the story was better known. The schooner had piled onto a reef that had already claimed a victim. See, back during the 16th century, when Spain controlled half the sea lanes of the world, an English vessel had left the West Country to challenge King Philip. She had a daring master and a bold crew. So rather than cruise the treasure ports of the Spanish Main, she had gone south, through Drake's Passage, and into virtually uncharted Pacific lanes. Here, the Spanish were most thinly spread, and pickings could be richer. The English mariner cried havoc to the isolated ships of the Pacific. He ran up the west coast of the Americas, picking up prizes wherever he could, and then headed for the big one. Every year, the Spanish sent two galleons from the Philippines to Mexico. These were large ships, well-armed but crammed with treasure. There might be a hard fight, but the pickings would make any English privateer rich for life. Steering west, the Englishman headed for treasure and glory, but he did not know the true nature of the Pacific. A storm blew up, driving the already battered ship before it until she piled up on an unknown reef near Midway Island. There, the master and the crew waited for another vessel. For centuries, they waited. Until the American schooner Star came ashore, and the Elizabethan mariners, long since dead and decayed, took over the new ship. Now they were roaming the Pacific, still without a chart, still hunting for prey. Star continued to cruise, possibly carried by the tides and the currents of the Pacific, possibly crewed by the Elizabethan phantoms, until, 4 years after they had been abandoned by her American crew, she again ran aground on the same reef off Midway Island. This time, however, there was no reprieve, and the great Pacific waves battered her into pieces. Wow. Now that is a crazy story, right? So the ship, I mean, the part with the ghostly people of centuries past manning the new ship and sailing it around. It's probably not true, but I don't know. I like to think that it is. But the ship, the Star, definitely ran aground in Midway Island. The crew definitely was taken off, taken to Seattle. They left the ship there. They thought it was useless. Turns out it was seen afloat months later, 6 months later, and the thing was seen all the way up by San Francisco. The thing was adrift in the ocean for years, 4 years, before only finally wrecked on the Midland Islands again and then finally was destroyed by the ocean. Can you imagine that thing just floating on its own all over the Pacific Ocean by itself? And then the tales of people seeing ghostly crews aboard. I don't know. I like stories like that. Now, this book isn't just about ghost ships. There's other things in there. And one of the chapters is dedicated to stowaways. You know, people that sneak aboard these ships and travel, you know, kind of like a hobo, but for the sea. There's one story that's pretty cool. It says that it sounds a bit harsh to think of what happened to some of these stowaways. But in the 1880s, Professor Warman, that's the name of the ship, sailed regularly from Hamburg to Great Britain with an occasional trip to the West Africa. It says in November 1883, the ship had made one of her longer voyages and was at Little Popo in West Africa. The crew were unloading their cargo, bale by bale, when somebody shouted for the captain. Turns out there was a body on board. At first, there was a horrible suspicion of murder, but then the captain put all the facts together. They had found a man lying dead on the deck of the hold, with the bales piled all around him to make a natural cave or hollow. He had an empty bottle of gin, and beside him, the bone of the leg of lamb. But the guy was stone dead. It seemed that he had died of thirst. The captain worked out what had happened. The man had waited until the ship had been loaded in Hamburg and had sneaked on board. He had secreted himself in the hold with enough food, he thought, for what would be the short voyage from Hamburg to Britain, hoping to starting a new life there. However, what he didn't know is they weren't going to Britain. They were going to West Africa. So the voyage was much longer than his food and drink would last, and they eventually ran out. So he must have lain there in the dark, not knowing what was happening, and without any means of calling for help, just slowly dying. There were no identification papers on him, so that man's identity was never discovered. So how terrible is that? The guy knows, or what he thinks, is this ship's going from Hamburg to Great Britain. I know. I got me some food here. I got me some gin. He got me, you know, I got my cup here. No one's chipped in. But I'm going to sneak on board this ship as a stowaway, and then I'll start a new life in Britain. What he didn't know is they were going to West Africa. And I guess once the bales were surrounded around him, there was no way to get out until they unloaded. So at some point, he ran out of food and drink and was stuck and just had to sit there until he starved to death. What a terrible way to go, right? But there's other stories, not just about stowaways, not just about ghost ships. There's stories of mermaids and cryptids and things like that. There's lots of other stories in this book. It's pretty cool. There's stories about ships that have disappeared. There's lots of stories of ships with ghosts. There's a lot of that. But sea monsters and creatures of the deep, even some haunted lighthouses or keepers of the light, they call them. There's a lot of cool stuff. So if you're into stories like that, you like strange tales, you like pirates, things about the ocean, you might check out this book. Like I said, I'll put links to it in the show notes. It's called Strange Tales of the Sea by Jack Strange, and I really enjoyed it. Let's take a break, folks. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. Pretty cool book if you like stories about the ocean, if you like, whether it's cryptids, you're into mermaids and things like that, or ghost ships.
And
or,
I am.
Or stowaways. Who's not, right? Strange Tales of the Sea by Jack Strange. Very interesting. Man, some of my favorite stories out of there are kind of like the messages in a bottle, where there's these ships that are lost at sea The crew's, the whole crew's dead, and the ship somehow are afloat aloft out in this ocean for 20 years. Just, they find them 2,000 or 3,000 miles away from where they left.
How strange is that?
They're just out there floating around.
Just,
and this isn't like a mirage. I mean, like, they actually physically find the ship and board it, and there's no one on it.
Just floating. Just out there floating.
That one was afloat, I think, for 23 years.
And you think, I guess with the way the currents work, it could work to where it just was caught in current, and it never, never comes back.
And especially the one where people would see it, and they said that it looked like it had a crew on it sometimes, and the crew looked like it was from a very earlier age.
That, those are my favorite stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, legitly, those ghost ships, and like that where it's...
I don't know what it is with the ocean, but it just seems like a romantic ideal, right?
No, it seems scary as hell. I hate that place.
Yeah, well, I've never been on a cruise or anything. I mean, I've been offshore fishing.
Yeah.
But I've never just been, like, out to sea.
I told you my wife is jumping up and down wanting me to go, and I just...
My wife wants me to go, and I just don't understand it. It's like a floating hotel. Like, why would I spend the money to go to a hotel?
It's like a floating bus. I don't want to ride the bus.
You know what I'm saying? Like, if
party.
I want to Cozumel, let's just go to Cozumel. Yeah. Why would I want to go to Cozumel for one day and then leave and then go to Tulum and then you're there for 6 hours, then you leave? I'm like.
But apparently, it's everybody I've talked to that's ever done it, they seem to really enjoy it.
I know. I
just think, do it. Let's just get our wives and go do it. And then we can just laugh and talk about it.
If I had to go on one, I think I'd probably rather go on one of those ones like. The Norwegian ones that go to like Norway and stuff like
that. I
want
to go to the Viking cruise ships. Cuba.
Oh, there you go. That'd be
Let's
cool.
go to Cuba. We can have Cuban sandwiches and smoke cigars.
And drink the little coffees and stuff.
Yeah.
Espressos.
All right. We're planning it. That's it. We're going. You and me and the wives are going on a cruise to Cuba.
You don't need the cruise ship. You can take your kayak. We could be there in like 4 hours. Cuba's not very far.
Was it like 15 miles?
I think it's like 53.
I thought it was 90.
I don't know. But there's little islands along the way. Like, you know, just like when they talk about
no,
the
I don't know, because I don't smuggle cocaine, Mr. Filson. Well, Kyle Filson.
Yeah, but you bought tickets to that fire festival, right? There in Pablo Escobar's old island. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I'm the guy that brought the hippos down.
That's a do you know that story about the fire festival that was a couple years ago?
No,
it was supposed to be like one of the, you know, like Coachella and Burning Man, these big musical things.
Yeah.
These big, and they're not a conference, but it's like Woodstock, okay? It's like Woodstock. I know you're older, so I'm trying to give it to somebody to compare it to.
Word, I'm down.
There was a guy, and he was supposed to have one of the biggest music festivals of all time, and he was supposed to be on a private island in the Bahamas. And the island was actually one of Pablo Escobar's islands, where he had just a runway on it, basically used it as a stopping, refueling spot to smuggle drugs from Colombia into the Florida, right?
I'm digging it.
So they had a big stage, and they were supposed to sell all these villas, and there was different price points. Like, the cheapest one was like 10 grand, and you got like a beachside little villa, right? Like a one-bedroom, really finely furnished. And they had up other packages, up to where it's like $200,000 or $300,000. And then they were going to have all kinds of bands, like Blink-182 was going to be there, Ja Rule, like a whole bunch. They sold this thing because it was going to be the biggest festival ever because, you know, they know that Coachella and Burning Man made all this money. Well, it turned out like it was all nonsense.
It was a scam?
There was nothing there. So all these people bought all these tickets. And when they got there, it wasn't even on a private island anymore. It had moved to another island in the Bahamas. They didn't have anything but like FEMA tents, which were basically crappy dome tents that you could get like at Academy or Walmart for like $15.
Wow.
And apparently several of the musicians pulled out at the last minute. Nobody got paid. They had day workers there in the Bahaman islands that have been working on this thing. None of them got paid. Anyways, the guy's in prison now. I mean, people sued him for millions of dollars.
Yeah, that's not good.
It was one of the biggest. Well, there's a documentary on Netflix if you care to watch it. But
I think you filled me in enough. I'm good.
Yeah, that's basically the gist of it.
Spoiler alert.
It was okay. I don't even know how we got talking about that. We were talking about sailing in the Bahamas and Cuba and stuff. Anyways.
So that's where you want to stop and hang out, is what you're telling me.
Not there, but I would definitely go to Pablo Escobar's former island. It looked beautiful. There's a lot of islands there, like, I mean, thousands that are small, unoccupied.
Well, now that you've brought up Florida, I have something for you, Brett.
Oh, here we go.
Florida man's at it again.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. This comes from NBC2.com, folks. In Palm Beach, Florida man who drove Ferrari into water said Jesus told him to.
No, I think it's Jesus told him to.
I guess it makes more sense whenever you bring that up. I guess he let Jesus take the wheel.
It could have been Jesus, though.
He drove his Ferrari into the Intracoastal in Palm Beach in late December and told police he did it because Jesus told me to. This is in the police report. Now, mind you, a Ferrari drove his Ferrari into the intracoastal.
Yeah.
Down there in late December 26th. James Mucanasino of Deerfield Beach was approached by a police officer as he was removing items from his Ferrari, which had been parked on a public dock. He told the officer that his friend told him to park on the dock so he could pick him up by boat. Well, when he couldn't park on the dock, says he apologized and went to retrieve his driver's license from the Ferrari. And so I'm assuming that while he's messing around in there, he was like, you know what? I'm going for it. And so pretty much it says that, you know, you'll really like this. So I guess, you know, all right, you can't stay here. Go get your stuff. He reverses it off the dock. Then he just puts the car in drive and just drops the hammer. And there is apparently dash cam video footage of it.
So he's like, well,
that's what it said. The officer was like, what do you get a load of this? It shoots out. He gets out of the water. All right. Two fishermen get him out as he jumps out. The officer goes, why did you do that? He said, Jesus told me to drive through a small gate and into a 6-foot window. That's what the guy said. So it's Jesus said, hey, drive through a small gate and into a 6-foot window. He also said that Jesus made me the smartest man on earth.
Evidently
not. And
it's
so hard to have this much responsibility. And he says, money is going to be irrelevant in 2 days. Remember to smile. And he stated that the reason he drove into the inlet is because the officer on the dock was Egyptian and did not believe in Jesus. And it says that it also revealed that the license plate, the investigation in this, was attached to the Ferrari, belonged to the guy's Mustang. So undoubtedly, this dude's got a whole lot of money, right?
Well, he is the smartest man in the world.
Smartest man in the world. And money will be irrelevant in 2 days, which would have been December 28th. And I don't know about y'all, but daddy still needs his paycheck. So it's not irrelevant. And I'm smiling now because apparently Jesus or Jesus or whoever it was talking to him was like, I would believe it was Jesus. Jesus is like, just gas it through that window.
Just go for it, bro. It reminds you of like live PD, you know, you're like,
don't need any money.
These people run from the cops and like they get in a high speed chase. They almost kill somebody. Mm-hmm. Now they're going to jail and they're like, what'd you run for? And the like, guy's like, I was scared. But like the cop was like, I was just pulling over because like your left taillight was out, bro.
Right.
You're like, you just went to prison for that?
That's right. I thought I had warrants. That's my favorite. I think I got warrants.
Well,
so you ran.
You know, they just lock you up and then you can pay your warrant and they'll let you out. I mean, it's not that big a deal. Did I ever tell that story on the air? I'm going to save it for the next OTC.
The OTC.
Remind me when we get over there.
Is this when you got locked up buying a snow cone?
Yeah. Did I ever tell that story?
I don't know if you ever did or not, but we're going to tell it on the next OTC.
I'll
you know
tell
what?
It.
Let's wrap this puppy up and let's just record one and kick it out.
Sounds good. For everybody out there, if you have a story of your own you'd like to share with me and Cam, don't forget you can email the show at expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. Or you can call the show 817-945-3828. You can follow us on all forms of social media. Be careful out there. Till next time, I'm Kyle Filson. He's Cam Hale.
Peace, y'all.
The sun doesn't shine, rainbows and waterfalls come through my mind.
As soon as my eyes see the sunshine.